This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
A massacre in Moscow suggests that Islamic State may be making a comeback, perhaps from a sanctuary in Afghanistan. Plus, the Biden administration raises the pressure on Israel, not Hamas, in its last bastion in the city of Rafah. But Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israel is going in anyway. The growing world disorder is our subject today in Potomac Watch. Welcome, I'm Paul Gigot with the WSJ Opinion Pages, here with my esteemed colleagues, Bill McGurn and Kim Strassel. Welcome. The massacre at the concert venue on the outskirts of Moscow on Friday evening, 137 killed so far, dozens wounded, many seriously. The killers fired away at the concert goers for a long time, set fire to the building, and then escaped in a car, if you can believe it. Terrible lapse of Russian security, which now says it has found at least four of the killers who've confessed under interrogation, including what appears to be torture, if you believe the release of the photos from the Russian security services. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin suggests that maybe Ukraine was responsible because the attackers were found heading toward Ukraine. Others in his government are blaming the U.S., but Ukraine denies it. And the U.S. says its information is that it was Islamic State, or ISIS as it's known, especially ISIS Khorasan, or the Afghan branch of ISIS, that has prospered in that country since President Biden's willy-nilly withdrawal in 2021. The U.S. says it warned Russia before the attack that one was possible, but before the attack, Putin had publicly dismissed that as American attempts to stir trouble. Bill, what do you make of Putin's claims and the evidence you see so far?
Well, we've been here before, right? The evidence so far is, I think, pretty overwhelming that it was ISIS-K that committed this. They took credit for it. The U.S. warned them about it. I don't think there's any evidence to support Putin's claim that it was Ukraine. That's a useful thing for him politically to help him double down on Ukraine. You know, he has a history of doing that with the Chechens and so forth, using war to strengthen his grip on power. So I don't think we can trust anything they say. It's amazing to me when you look at what they were able to accomplish. I think it was four men.
Right.
They were shooting for about an hour, roughly an hour, in Moscow. And they got away by car. Can you imagine going into New York, into Manhattan? First of all, the traffic would kill you. But,
well, for that matter, Bill, let's say a suburb of Washington. I mean, right. You know, escaping by car into the Maryland woods? I don't think
so. 66? No.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it reminds us how vulnerable we are, because I think ISIS has planned further attacks on Europe and so forth. And it's reconstituting itself, maybe not the same as it was before, and muddying all the waters. It's a real threat. And I don't know that we're going to respond strongly enough.
The U.S., Kim, says that it warned Putin under its policy, which they call a duty to warn other governments when the U.S. has intelligence that there might be an attack. It did the same thing before the ISIS attack on Iran, which took place in early January, which killed 84 people in Iran. Iran apparently didn't take that seriously enough either. Russia clearly didn't take this seriously. And I think this attempt to blame Ukraine and this attempt to blame the United States helps deflect from the fact that this was a real dereliction of Russian security.
Yeah, I think it serves a couple of purposes on Putin's point. As you know, we did warn, and quite specifically, the U.S. Embassy, in fact, publicly on March 7th, warned American citizens to avoid concert venues, which would suggest that America had some pretty specific intelligence. It says that it warned again about a week later. Interestingly, at the time, Russia called those warnings provocative and suggested they were intended to intimidate and destabilize the Russian society. So who knows how much attention they were paying. But regardless of the warnings that were ignored, I think, as you say, this deflects a certain degree to an abysmal failure. I mean, remember, this is a security state, Russia. And yet it turns out that when you really need the security, they're nowhere to be found. But the other thing is, by intimating that this has something to do with Ukraine, and Putin has been kind of cagey about this. He came out and gave an address. He didn't directly blame Ukraine. Instead, he suggested they were assisting in the getaway of these ISIS characters, which makes no sense whatsoever. Ukraine has strongly disavowed this.
Well, that suggests that they knew about it.
Yes, exactly. So he's playing games. But look, I think it's really important. Russia has done this. Putin has done this many times before. Back in 1999, there was a series of apartment bombings. People now, in retrospect, think that they were false flag operations, inside jobs staged by Putin and his allies. But they blamed it on the Chechens. He used it to launch the Second Chechen War, elevate himself to power. And he has a history of doing this. When his control looks threatened in the country, he uses moments like this. I'm not suggesting this ISIS attack wasn't real, but he uses these moments to shore up support for himself as a strong man, the strong leader of Russia. I think it's not surprising that even as these threats have come through, they issued yet more orders to conscript new series of Russians to go and fight in the Ukrainian war. The intimation this was Ukraine is going to be used to try to rally support for a war that has now dragged into its third year. This is Putin up and down.
All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the Moscow massacre and its implications, particularly the rise of ISIS, when we come back.
AI may be the most important new computer technology ever, but AI needs a lot of processing speed, and that gets expensive fast. Upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/wallstreet. oracle.com/wallstreet.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal, and I'm here with my colleagues Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. And let's listen to Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, talking Sunday about the implications from the Moscow massacre of the return of Islamic State.
This is the unfortunate echo of President Biden's chaotic and disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. It's the same group that killed 13 Americans. Just a few days ago at the Armed Services Committee, I asked our commanding general in the Middle East about ISIS's capacity to project attacks from Afghanistan. He said that in as little as 6 months, and it turned out to be closer to 6 days, that ISIS from Afghanistan, with little or no warning, could attack Western interests across Asia and Europe. And that's exactly what we've seen happen. It's deeply regrettable that innocent civilians, women, and children were killed in Moscow, but the next attacks could be against an American embassy in Asia or in Europe, or against, say, students traveling to Europe on a school trip for spring break. Again, this is a very dangerous echo of President Biden's failed withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Bill, this is, I think, an extremely important point that Cotton makes, and politically resonant as well. Just as a factual matter, we had feared that after the withdrawal from Afghanistan of the U.S., meaning we no longer have any listening posts there, we no longer have any ability to attack a terror base if it develops, we feared that there would be a new sanctuary potentially for ISIS and Al-Qaeda. The Taliban now that rule Afghanistan are competing with ISIS. They don't like each other. On the other hand, it doesn't appear the Taliban has the wherewithal or maybe even the desire to take on ISIS in Afghanistan, much as it didn't back in the 1990s when Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden was using it as a sanctuary. And the real risk there is that if you have a sanctuary like this, ISIS can use it as a base to plan future attacks. And we know, okay, we've got the Iran attack in January. We've now got this Moscow attack. France says it has foiled an attack this year. And France is now on the highest terror alert it has as the Summer Olympics approach in Paris. And then you add that to the testimony that Cotton cites. We're back in a pretty dangerous place here.
Yeah, Paul, you may have worried about becoming a sanctuary again, and Senator Cotton did in the Journal editorial page, but that was certainly not what Joe Biden was worried about, or at least what he told us. What was the phrase? Over the horizon capability?
Yep.
We're going to prevent it from becoming sanctuary. We could fly over and do things. It proved to be false. You have to be there. You know, when I was in the Bush White House, one of the rationales for being in Afghanistan is just keep them busy in their hiding out in their tunnels there and so forth, so they don't come over here. Bush constantly said, fight them over there so they don't come here. Now we're going to see them spread out. We don't know where they are. And again, what worries me about Moscow is that it's pretty low-level technology. Even in a security state like Russia, as Kim points out, there are soft targets, very soft targets. And it's not hard for guys with guns to mow down a lot of people. And we're kidding ourselves if we think they haven't figured that out. I think it's a challenge. Look, it certainly is bad news for Vladimir Putin, who is supposed to protect the Russian people. His whole argument is he's a strong man. He's going to keep them safe, defeat foreign threats. It's bad for Joe Biden because it's a consequence of the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think it's slightly a challenge to Donald Trump, reminding him that it's important to have our soldiers in different parts of the world that are dangerous, because threats can really fester and manifest themselves later in attacks if we don't. It's a lot less costly to have troops in these sensitive parts of the world than to try to play catch up after an attack.
So the question becomes, 7 months to go or so before the presidential election, long time to go, Kim, it looks to me as if there's a vulnerability here politically, potentially, for the president. I mean, Bill's point is very well taken about Donald Trump and troops on the ground. And I think that, you know, Trump wanting to pull out our forces from Syria and Iraq, small troop deployments, intelligence listening posts, really, would be a mistake. And Trump has wanted those out. So that would be a mistake because they give us valuable intel about ISIS and Iran and other things. But Biden is responsible for having withdrawn from Afghanistan. And if Afghanistan is found to be where plots against Americans are planned and ultimately executed, I think this is very dangerous territory for the president.
Yes, because you're looking at two sides of a coin. When you withdraw, you lose that listening capability, but you also, on the other hand, create a vacuum, a place where they can fill back in again. The Taliban is proving incapable of stopping ISIS-K in that country. But we have a risk in other places. You just mentioned Syria and Iraq. Only recently, the Wall Street Journal had a story about a recent security sweep at a refugee camp in northern Syria that holds about 44,000 people. They found dozens of ISIS militants in there. There are some 9,000 ISIS fighters that are currently in detention centers in Syria. And the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is the Kurdish-led force that joined with the U.S. to defeat ISIS and is still supported by the U.S., it is struggling to contain and maintain operations against ISIS and stop them from filling up Syria as well, too. So if we pull support from there, you're potentially helping to create another haven. Similarly, situation in Iraq. And the president clearly bears responsibility here. There is a direct line, as Cotton said, between our evacuation and leaving of Afghanistan and what is now going on. And I only hope this does become a point of real divide and debate in the presidential election, because we are looking at a global disorder at the moment in many different regions of the world. And now added to that, in addition to the Ukrainian war and everything going on with Israel, we have the rise of Islamic State again, and it ought to be front and center, this question to the candidates, who's going to be more aggressive at stopping that?
All right, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to turn to the rising tensions between the United States and Israel, which has come into the fore again here at the United Nations and elsewhere, when we come back.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker. Play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn here. Let's turn to another subject in the global turmoil, and that is the tension between the United States and Israel. Those are increasing as the Biden administration argues that the Israeli government should not make a military campaign in Rafah, which is the last stronghold of Hamas in Gaza. Several thousand Hamas terrorists are alleged to be based there, and Israel says it cannot destroy Hamas unless it goes in. But Biden and Kamala Harris are really getting very vocal in saying that is something the U.S. opposes. Let's listen to Vice President Harris.
We have been clear in multiple conversations and in every way that any major military operation in Rafah would be a huge mistake. Let me tell you something. I have studied the maps. There's nowhere for those folks to go. And we're looking at about 1.5 million people in Rafah who are there because they were told to go there, most of them. And so we've been very clear that it would be a mistake to move into Rafah with any type of military operation.
A mistake, but would there be consequences if he does move forward?
Well, we're going to take it one step at a time, but we've been very clear in terms of our perspective on whether or not that should happen.
Are you ruling out that there would be consequences from the United States?
I am ruling out nothing.
Well, that's pretty tough talk. Meanwhile, on Monday, the United States abstained from a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, unlinked to the return of the hostages. They're now demanding the release of the hostages, but separate from the demand for a ceasefire. And the Israelis oppose the resolution. They don't get a vote in the Security Council. And in response, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, said he will no longer send a delegation he had been planning to the United States to discuss Rafah and some alternatives to the planned Israeli campaign, both to brief the White House on what Israel was planning and to hear some alternatives. That delegation had been requested by President Biden. Now Netanyahu is withdrawing it. Bill, the disagreement is building. I think, and all our reporting suggests, that Netanyahu and the Israeli government, and this isn't just the prime minister, this is unanimous within the war cabinet and supported by the Israeli people, they're going to go into Rafah one way or another.
Yes, for obvious reasons. I think they look at the horrific attack they suffered. They had withdrawn from Gaza, 20 years ago, and the consequence was this horrific attack on innocent Israeli citizens from babies to grandmas. And when they do something, they want it really to be done. They don't want a half-finished job. They want to eliminate Hamas as a threat. And that's difficult because they're holed up in a populous area. But I think they feel they have no choice. This is an existential kind of threat to them. And it's just amazing to me that the United States would question an ally fighting for its life, really, and be so public with the disagreements. From the start, I was worried. Joe Biden took a great start, went to Israel, delivered some great remarks, was rhetorically fine. We were on their side. And I just wondered, is he still going to be with us when it gets tough, when that stand gets hard to do? The same way so many Democrats parachuted out after we went into Iraq. They were all for it in the beginning, but when it got tough, they wanted to withdraw. So he has a history of this, but I am stunned at the speed and how public they made it. Among friends, you can say really harsh things in private, get it all out there, debate and so forth. But I don't think you present those fights. What is the result of this fight? Now we have a security resolution that has de-linked the hostages from a ceasefire. Now a ceasefire is just for the ceasefire. It's not even about the hostages, right? They're separate things. It's amazing how fast we've done this. What is the incentive of that? It's for Hamas not to budge, which they haven't budged from the beginning. And I'll just add the final point. There's 4 Americans among those hostages, and I think 32 dead. And we never hear anything about that. And Joe Biden, like with Ukraine, with Israel, he supports them. He never seems to want a conclusion to fighting. Just go along, but not do too much, not do anything to win. And I think this is the case with the Israelis say, we have to defend our country. We don't have a choice. We have to go in. A
couple of ramifications of this, Kim. Domestic politics is one of them. It's obvious that the president is in some way responding to the pressure he's getting from the Democratic left, so-called Dearborn, Michigan problem he has with Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, and the youth vote who side with the Palestinians, if not Hamas. He seems to be trying to accommodate them in some way, but I think he has to be careful politically because all the polling that I've seen still shows that the majority of the American public supports Israel against Hamas. Even if you frame the question as Israel versus the Palestinians, most Americans support Israel. Now it's a little different among the young, more favorable to the Palestinians for younger voters, which is a big part of the Democratic constituency. But Biden has to be very careful here because if he really has a broad rift with Israel, that could begin to cost him politically, particularly if the Republicans start to make a case against it. And then there's the international side of it, which is, what message are we sending to our friends around the world, not just Israel, about our staying power?
Yeah, it's a huge risk, Paul. Although, can I just say really quickly, I'd like to note that it fills me with confidence knowing that Kamala Harris has studied the maps. That definitely makes me feel better about where this administration is. So anyway, and in fact, maybe Joe Biden should be taking advice from someone else than Kamala Harris, especially on the politics. I totally understand what the White House thinks it is doing here. If you look at all of the actions out of this White House in the past months, even maybe the past years, it's all about keeping its base happy. It's now focused on the election and it's entirely worried about turnout. And so it's very much dancing to the progressive tune. And you've seen what started as a bit of backsliding on Israel now turn into a turnabout. But as you say, the vast majority of Americans have different views. I think the vast majority of Americans also understand the Israeli argument here, which is what alternative do they have if they're not allowed to go into Rafah? They have done a very good job debilitating Hamas, but the reality is that a majority of Hamas fighters are still alive. Many of them have gathered in Rafah. If you stop at this point, a lot of it is for naught. You have to actually take them out. And, you know, Israel has said that there are ways to evacuate civilians to humanitarian islands. They have a plan for this. And we don't have a White House that's giving a plan back other than stop. And so I do think that that is a problem for the White House and something that a lot of Americans will see through. But yes, also, this is another show of weakness. And it goes back to where we ended up in the first place with this attack in Moscow after our precipitous and haphazard withdrawal from Afghanistan. At every turn, this president seems to say, I have my limits, and my limits are not what we need to get stuff done. Russia is watching this. China is watching this. Iran is watching this. ISIS is watching this. And it also sends a message to our other allies not to stand up and be counted or put your head up over the turret, because if the United States won't do it, then why should they?
Well, it's going to be a fascinating several months as we watch the events on the world stage really, I think, take a bigger and more prominent role in the American election than they typically do, because the world is, well, not to put too fine a point on it, the world is a mess. And it's getting worse. Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Kim. Thank you all for listening. We hope you'll be with us every day here on Potomac Watch. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast service, and we'll hope to have you here tomorrow and every day. Thanks for listening.